name is Bruce Kane, and I'm the director of the Institute of Governmental Studies and the director of the UC Washington Center and a professor here at Berkeley. Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared that he's the leader of the Purple Nation, that he's going to push the theme of post-partisanship, possibly even trying to influence the presidential election and get people to think of some of his across-party initiatives and modes of governing. So this panel is about whether the premise that there is different there are different colored nations out there, red, blue, and purple, is one of the questions we want to ask. Does it really make sense to talk about the country and the state as being divided into different areas, red and blue? And to what extent does it apply to California? We know that people use this framework frequently around the country, but is it also true of California? And to what extent is the east-west divide in California a replication of the red and blue divisions that we see, red, blue, and purple, I should say, across the country? And to what extent was Arnold's reelection something deeper than just his popularity and his charisma? Was there anything else going on there? Is he onto something and trying to appeal to the middle? Certainly, it brings to mind George Lakoff's observation that many people in the middle are not really in the middle of all the spectrum, but they're a jumble of a lot of contradictory views, and perhaps nobody illustrates that more than Arnold. So the whole question, the whole framework of red and blue, of different areas, of color coding, reaching across the lines is the topic of this panel, and we really have three very good speakers to address this. And we're going to start with Professor Morris Fiorina. Mo wrote a book before the last election, which really asked a lot of probing questions about the media's use of red and blue, and is, I think it's fair to say, a skeptic as to whether that's a good description of the electorate and feels that it's a better description of the elites. So we have probably the foremost critic of this whole way of thinking in Professor Morris Fiorina, who is a professor of politics at Stanford, co-author with me of a book many, many years ago, and that was something that he and I won't ever forget. It was a lot of work, partly because of the third author, but anyway. we didn't do his share, and Mo and I did most of it, but never mind. I'm not bitter. Are you bitter? and then we have Thad Kauser, who is no stranger to us at Berkeley, one of our more eminent graduate students, who is editing a book currently for the IGS on precisely the topic of the geopolitics of California. And he's going to talk about some of the work. I'm part of that project, and he's going to talk about some of the work that comes out of that. And then we have Ted Lasher, who is with the Department of Public Policy and Administration at Cal State Sacramento, who's also done a lot of work on direct democracy in California politics. So with that, let's start with Professor Fiorina.
Thanks, Bruce, and thank you all for showing up on a Saturday morning, which is something I rarely do. I changed the title because I didn't think anyone would seriously argue that California was red. So the question is it blue or purple? And I think even a lot of the younger people in California would probably think this is a pretty straightforward, a question with a straightforward answer, that of course it's blue. But if you're as old as I am, you can remember when things were really different, when California was, if not red, at least a shade of reddish purple. Nowadays we think of California as Hollywood and San Francisco and medical marijuana and gay marriage, the first third world state with an occasional fit like electing Arnold Schwarzenegger. But at one point there were lots of Republicans who won. And this is most obvious at the presidential level. There we go. California went Democratic during the New Deal, and Harry Truman hung on by about 0.5% in 1948. Then it was a long string of Republicans, 9 out of 10 elections until Bill Clinton, only Goldwater, managed to lose it for the Republicans. And political scientists really talked about California being part of the Republican base back in the 80s. And so things really changed very quickly in the early 90s. I went back and looked at the gubernatorial races, and Democrats actually went 40 years without electing a governor early in the century. And if you start with Earl Warren coming in, other than the Browns, until the 1990s, the Democrats don't do very well at the gubernatorial level either. The line at the bottom shows 43 years of Republicans and 21 years of Democrats, and were it not for the recall election and the funny circumstances there, the disparity would be even greater. Senate was more competitive, mainly because of Alan Cranston. Hiram Johnson was a Republican senator from about the time of the Noah's Flood, and so I started after him when he retired. If you start there, Republicans controlled the Senate for 54 years and Democrats for 42 years up until 1992. And then, as you can see, after that, there's zero Republican years. And so when you really look at it, California goes from red or reddish-purple at the national and the statewide races to a definite shade of blue very quickly. It's the kind of political scientists refer to things like this as realignments. These are the kind of indicators we use. And yet, the explanation for this is considered very simple, and this came out again and again during the congressional debate over immigration in the spring, when the House bill, the enforcement-only bill, the Senate bill, Enforcement Plus, and people kept talking about California. Prop 187, basically Pete Wilson killed the California Republican Party in 1994 when, to get himself reelected, he hitched on to 187 and thereby managed to win one election, but the price was alienating Latinos and making California Republicans the minority party. Just to illustrate the sad state of fact-checking in the media today, this is The Economist, which is a high-quality paper. As you may note, the Republicans lost control of the legislature in 1966, so it seems a little excessive to blame that on Wilson in 1994, but the general picture they're painting is right here. Wall Street Journal published an article called "Oh for Pete's Sake," in which they say that Wilson's campaign was disastrous for his party. By the end of the decade, the Democrats controlled everything. I guess David Broder isn't coming, I've heard, but he wrote a column in which he said the Bushies were really sort of concerned that the congressional Republicans were going to do a California on the National Republican Party by alienating Latinos. And the conventional wisdom is pretty well summed up here. Ben Dixon is a pollster for a lot of Latino organizations. And Pete Wilson, Prop 187, and basically California went blue because of the big shift of Latinos to the Democratic Party. Well, political scientists, I guess academics in general, love to question conventional wisdom. And it just makes us really happy to do it. And for me, I got really excited when I was reading the report of the Secretary of State last spring, and these numbers jumped out at me. And just to make this a little easier to see, okay, the top line is the number of registered Democrats. The bottom line is the number of registered Republicans. And what's interesting is the number of registered Democrats in California peaked in 1994. It's actually declined since. So arithmetically, whatever gains the Democrats have made among the Latino segment of the population have been offset by losses in other population groups. Republicans have actually come up some. They've cut the gap between Democrats and Republicans over this period. Where did these 1.4 million new voters go that came into the electorate during this period? Here we are. Bottom line, these are the no party and the independent registration. And as you can see, it's really coming up fast. I got this into Schwarzenegger's speech. I passed this diagram and a memo on to some people there. So that was the source of the non-majority, the non-party majority. And this is actually happening around the country. Connecticut has more no party than Democrats. Massachusetts has no party than Republicans. It's kind of an interesting political science question because we're not showing any shifts in party identification, just blips up and down as one party does better. But around the country, it looks like voter registration is shifting just generally in this independent direction, even while party ID is staying strong. Now, there's no denying that Latinos have helped the Democrats during this period. Latino voter registration is going up. That's the bottom line right here. Bottom line. And the support for candidates at the top of the ticket, you see, is a little higher. But Field at one point did a report in which they calculated the Latino edge, the margin that they're contributing to the Democratic margins. As you can see, no politician is going to throw away, 4 or 5% margin. But it's gone from around, the low single digits in the early 90s to sort of the medium to high single digits today. And That's got to be a small part of the picture, given the margins by which some of the Republicans have lost in recent statewide races. You know, so it's no denying that it helps. If you're a politician, you want it. But there's other things going on. The other things going on are pretty obvious. Contrast the height of the Republican era. Dick Majan has a 60-40 victory for governor in 86. In the depths of the Republican era, Lundgren gets beaten by the same margin, about 60-40. And you can see the losses among ethnic groups, Latinos, but much bigger losses Lundgren suffers, given the size of the population, among whites. Let me just put it all at once. Democrats, Dick Majan gets a certain number of Democratic votes. He carries the independents. Lundgren loses the independents badly. Dick Majan gets a certain amount of crossover from liberals. He carries the moderates. Lundgren loses badly the moderates. Dick Majan cuts into the union vote. Dick Majan carries the affluent. Lundgren can't even carry the affluent in the state. That what's really happened to Republicans is they've lost the middle. And just, again, using field polls, as far back, we haven't, this is about as far back as we've been able to go. But basically, Republicans are carrying a majority of the moderates in the late 80s, presumably earlier. They lose them. They're doing very badly. Same thing with independents, no partisan preference. And so what's really happening, I think, or what really happened, was that California went blue to red as a consequence of the movements in the red to blue, or purple to blue, as a consequence of the movements in the National Republican Party, that the kinds of strategy that made you stronger in Texas and Mississippi and Alabama was the kind of strategy that made you much weaker in California. And I think if Republicans could, if they could find more candidates like Wilson's and Tom Campbell's and Ed Shaw's and going back farther, Ked Matte's and so forth, I think they still could be very competitive. I think California is still purple underneath, but as long as the Republicans keep running the kinds of candidates they do, and Schwarzenegger is a fluke in the sense of how he came to office, not a fluke in terms of the kind of candidate who can run. But if there were ways for Republicans to get more of those kind of candidates and put them on the ballot, then there would, at least at the statewide and at the national level, I think be a basically purple California.
Thanks, Bob. I want to make 3 points about the political colors of California, and I'm going to have to also rely on some slides to do that. The first is that the reason why California's had a blue legislature and a red, reddish governor now over the past few decades, and the reason that this has been a chronic condition over the past few decades, is that the system is set up structurally to do that, because the legislature is elected. The constituency that elects the legislature is residents. The constituency that elects the governor and that determines the results of direct democracy elections is voters. And these are two very different groups in California today, and they make different choices. And so we shouldn't be surprised to see Republican governors in a firmly Democratic legislature. The second point I'm going to make is that Governor Schwarzenegger, even though he may be a purple governor, a post-partisan governor, a new kind of governor, so far he hasn't really changed the electoral map of California, the red-blue map. He hasn't caused a political realignment. He hasn't done well in areas. He hasn't done well in areas of traditional Democratic strength while losing areas of traditional Republican strength. He's just done better than Republicans do in Republican heartland before. That's been the pattern early in his career. He may be changing that now, but I'm going to show you some maps that try to make the case that he didn't bring a political realignment in California. And the third point I'm going to make comes out of this project that Bruce alluded to. It's going to be a book on the new political geography in California that some French demographers, as well as folks like Bruce, Rafe Sonenshein in L.A., Ken Miller is a co-editor of it, who's here in the audience today. We're looking at trends that demographic trends that help explain some of the political trends in California. One of the things that we'll see, and we'll see when I show you the red-blue map, is that California is becoming increasingly an east-west divided state, rather than the north-south divisions that governed for much of California's history. A lot of that east-west divide can be explained by demographic shifts, especially trends in where evangelical Christians have lived and moved to in California. So let me go back to the first state. So why does California have a blue legislature and reddish governors? Well, this is due to the two constituencies problem that Bruce has raised. Governors, the legislature is represented, is drawn, legislative districts are drawn so that every district has about, 460,000 residents in an assembly district, right? The equal residents. And so every district, no matter how many voters it has, gets the same one vote in Sacramento. So if you take a district like the 52nd Assembly District, this is Merv Dimely's district in Los Angeles. This is an area with a lot of minority voters. There are a lot of people who are not citizens or not and not eligible to vote, and it has very low voter turnout. About 40,000 people from that district turn out in statewide gubernatorial elections and in initiative races. They get one vote in Sacramento in the Assembly. Compare that to the 4th Assembly District. This is Ted Gaines' district, Sacramento, up into some of the Sierra foothills. A lot of eligible voters, a lot of people who participate, more than three times as many voters in initiative races and in governor's races, and again, just that single vote in the Assembly District. So the legislature is representing people who look like the folks in the 52nd Assembly District. And we have a majority in the legislature of folks representing people who come from communities that have a lot of low turnout, poor California, and they've been able to capture a majority in the legislature, but their power is very much diluted in statewide races because these folks just don't turn out and their votes can't count. Mark Baldessari and the PPIC put out a great report called The Exclusive Electorate that compares residents and voters. They're very different, and in short, residents voters are a bit older, whiter, and a bit more conservative than residents. And that explains why we have a governor who's older, whiter, and a little bit more conservative than the legislature. It shouldn't be that surprising. This explains the disjuncture between governors and legislatures, and if you look at direct democracy, especially when you're looking at the big issue before the legislature this year, it can help explain, it should give the governor a bit of a pause. You know, right now, in Governor Schwarzenegger's first term, he threatened to go to the initiative process a lot. And one of the reasons he did that is because this structural two constituencies problem gives the governor a strategic advantage. If he says, look, we're going to put something on the ballot, that means it's his electorate, voters, who are going to be deciding on a ballot initiative, not the legislature's constituency residents. So even though Governor Schwarzenegger might be more in touch with the people and a better communicator, a big part of why people thought he would win initiative races is that it was playing to his constituency. If you look at health care, this is what happened with California's last attempt to do big, major health care reform. John Burton's SB2, big universal health care bill, sort of a smaller step than what the governor is now proposing, won in the legislature, overwhelming 25-15 Senate vote. Then it was challenged, put up for a referendum, and it won in those 25 Senate districts where their members voted for it. Everybody was voting their districts. The legislature was not way out in front of their constituency in this. The legislature was exactly in touch with a constituency, the poor constituency of residents who wanted this. But because those districts don't have as many voters, it lost statewide. This shows that the governor may, now that he has moved sort of into a bluer health care proposal, he may run into some problems when he tries, if he faces a referendum on this, because it will be voted on by a redder constituency of voters. All right. We go to the second point, which is that at least in his first term, Governor Schwarzenegger didn't redraw the political map of California. So this is party registration, the red-blue map, and I use white for purple here, of what California looked like ideologically in party registration right before the recall. As you see, hey, the Bay Area North is the blue heartland, as is Los Angeles. You've got Orange County as a Republican stronghold, some of the Inland Empire, and the Central Valley. These are assembly districts, so it sort of shows you equal population rates. One thing that this map hides is the great difference within some of these communities. So research that Bruce Cain and Frederick Duzet have done that's going to be published in our book shows that increasingly Democrats live with other Democrats and Republicans live with other Republicans. And so some of the east-west divide that you see here also takes place within individual counties and areas. So in Los Angeles, you know, drive on Interstate 10 from the People's Republic of Santa Monica out to the Inland Empire, you're going from blue to red in the same way. That's like taking a flight from New York to Nebraska. You do see a lot of polarization within these communities. It's hidden by this map, but we see a big east-west divide here. Now, look at what happened in the recall. It's a pretty similar map. Look at that. You know, it's just that Governor Schwarzenegger did better than normal in the places that are normally Republican strongholds, and ran about 10 points ahead of where Bill Simon ran. If you look at this is the vote for the recall. If you look at this with the vote in the governor's race, Arnold Schwarzenegger just did particularly well in Republican strongholds. He didn't bring a realignment and do better in Democratic areas and worse in any Republican areas. We don't have the data yet to draw these maps from 2006, but my guess is it will be pretty similar, and it remains to be seen whether Governor Schwarzenegger can really redraw the partisan map of California. The last point I want to make is trying to explain some of this east-west divide and why it has become increasingly salient by looking at some of the demographic trends in California. So this map shows evangelicals in 1971. The darker blue areas are the places with more evangelicals. And we've got L.A. as the home of the heathens in California. That was the county with the fewest evangelicals, 3.4% in 1971. And the Inland Empire, it's really the heartland there for evangelicals. Today, California overall is much holier, much more evangelical. The Bay Area is the home of the heathens now. Although it's important to note that a lot of the evangelicals in Los Angeles and the Bay Area are African American and Latino, and less politically conservative. But the Central Valley is really where the strength of the evangelical movement has gone. This causes a lot of the divide on social issues that has determined a lot of the politics of Republican primaries, and with more gay marriage initiatives possibly on the way, may play an increasing role in the overall political divides in California. Thanks. This is research I should know by Ariane Zambiris, who's a French scholar. I think this is a self-description in a survey rather than... She had two forms of data. I can't remember which one into this map. Yeah. Yeah. There is church membership data. An interesting finding is if you ask churches how many people go, there's a lot less church turnout than when people self-describe themselves. So this is one of the two things.
It's just they got more involved. There's actually no trend over the last 30 years. It is, yeah.
Yeah, well, I agree that the politically relevant thing is how many people turn out at these churches, which are then mobilizing politically. Yeah, uh-huh. So I should make sure which.
Yeah, I survived that. Okay. With the basis of where the church is located.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk
okay.
about that. Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Okay, we can get to that in the question and answer.
Hi, thanks for inviting me. I'm going to cover some of the same grounds that Mo did, and some different, and I'll mostly agree with him on big points, maybe disagree with on some smaller things. And what I'm going to talk about is mainly based on my analysis with my colleague John Corey at Cal Poly Pomona of field poll data over about 22 years, basically looked at as aggregates, and then juxtaposing that with national data on party identification. So what's been called in the recent political science literature as macro partisanship. And I took seriously the notion that I should be brief. So we ran during this project probably 100 regressions, 1,000 figures, and 1,000,000 tables. I'm going to spare you most of that and just try to make the big points. So I'm going to mainly make four big themes, and then I'm going to leave you with one deliberately provocative, rhetorical sort of question. First of all, the first big theme is that our evidence, this is identification data rather than registration data, over a long time series, suggests that California did become significantly more blue in the 1990s, and blue relative to the rest of the country. What we described as a sort of soft V pattern, where in the early 80s, from the early 80s to actually about 91, California was becoming more Republican in terms of people's identification. And then from 1991 through the early part of this decade, becoming significantly more Democrat, and Democrat relative to other states. So that if you actually juxtapose a map of aggregates of field polls to aggregates of CBS New York Times polls over a long series, you find California moving significantly in the Democratic direction, again, relative to the nation as a whole. There are a few other states like that, but the work of Jerry Reid and others suggests that that's not all states. California is one of some states like that. Secondly, that the trend in identification was particularly pronounced among Latinos and Asian Americans. That is, relative to whites, Latinos and Asian Americans were becoming more Democratic in the 1990s. It wasn't simply that there were more Latinos, but that they were becoming more Democratic, that they started out more heavily Democratic and were becoming more so. I think I'll say something about Asian Americans just because we haven't talked about them at all. One interesting thing is that as of 1991, which was actually the peak for Republicans in the modern era in terms of identification, Asian Americans were as likely to identify with the Republican Party as Caucasians as of 1991. As of the early part of this decade, it was 3-2 Democratic edge in identification. And this work, again, it's not completely clear, and some of it may have to do with 187 or not, but I think it is consistent with the notion that there was a push away as a result of 187 and other factors. Although it's not completely clear because there's some evidence that started before then. The third theme I'd suggest, and I think this probably is especially more consistent with Moe's other work, there isn't much evidence that at the same time Californians became more liberal. In fact, if you look at the breakdown in terms of ideology, there just isn't a lot of, since the 1970s, there just isn't a lot of clear trends with respect to ideology. And so, you know, there are things poke around, but the sort of relative distributions of moderates, liberals, and conservatives hasn't changed much. And a fourth and related point is that there's no evidence that, in terms of that this is the polarization argument, there isn't much evidence that the moderates have disappeared. In fact, I didn't say I'd spare you all figures and tables. I'm only going to give you one because I think this is kind of cute. This is the trend in moderation for college graduates only. And I use college graduates because that's a group that's more likely to vote and turn out. So you look at just among college graduates, this comes about as close as sort of stationary set as you could find. That if you look at sort of the trend and proportion of all the people in the polls who self-identify as moderates have bounced around 30% for 22 years or something like that. So it's also worth reminding that while the Latino population in the United States, in the California, has been more Democratic for a long time and becoming increasingly so, Latinos aren't particularly, most of you probably know, aren't particularly liberal. So what we have, if you sort of put it all together, you have California becoming more blue relative to the country, led the way by sort of the big ethnic minority groups, although there's some movement among whites as well. Not at the same time, not a lot of ideological change, and certainly no evidence that strong polarization. And maybe this does, I think, consistent with what my question asks. My question, the provocative question I would ask for you is: do the statewide Republican leadership get it in the sense that they're conscious of the fact that they really are the minority party, and that this has something to do with perceptions of ethnic minorities? Let me leave you just a few tea leaves to suggest that maybe they don't. And I'm not talking now about the governor or his people right around him or things like that, but I'm talking about sort of statewide Republican leadership or people who are recruiting candidates, etc. This last election, every single Republican candidate for statewide office was a white male. Over the last three elections, the Republicans have run exactly one Latino for statewide office. Many of the candidates they put in the last couple of years have been among the most strident in the conservative brand. Think about Tony Strickland or Tom McClintock. I could pass you out little California Chamber of Commerce pictures of all the legislators. And Republican legislators won't exactly look like a model of diversity. And so it is the final tea leaf I might suggest to you. After an election in which the Democrats swept, of course, the congressional races, but which a moderate Republican, bucking the trend, won by a very substantial margin, running as a moderate, the Republicans in the Assembly replaced their conservative white male leader with a still more conservative white male, and the Republicans in the Senate came within one vote of doing the same thing. Thanks.
Okay, we're going to open it up to questions. I do want to make one, let me just make one observation, and that is that, and this reinforces what many of the panelists were saying about the underlying shakiness of the red-blue divide. When we went into this 2006 election, people were saying that the redistricting had created a situation in which the Democrats couldn't take control of the Congress. And one of the things I spent the fall telling people is, on the other side of the coin, when you actually do redistricting, you get a lot more nervous. You get sweaty palms about your attempt to fix things. Now, I realize there's not a lot of sympathy out there for gerrymanders who are trying to fix things. But I want to make the point that when you're relying on registration data and you see increasing numbers of people that are declined to stay, and when you realize that the candidate races that you base your projections are the outcomes of those races are dependent not only on what voters decide, what their preferences are, but which candidates are put forward. So that in congressional races, you have a whole bunch of races that often the challenger is so weak, you really don't know how strong the incumbent is, or the choices are so ideologically skewed that you don't know what happens when two moderates run against one another. It's very hard to fix an election with shaky data. Now, I think they tried in many cases, and Michael Berman did as good a job as anybody could do, but Michael Berman was relying, and I know he's always relied, very heavily on registration data. But when you have all those declined states and you have that faulty data, you can't say that that thing, that those walls are so great that the waters won't flow over them. And so it didn't surprise me that once you got to a national wave of 3 or 4 or 5%, that a lot of those seats were going to fall. And we also know that those national waves rarely are uniform, that sometimes those swings out in the areas like Indiana or in Pombo seat were far greater even than the national average, for reasons which we won't go into right now. So all this, I think, this red and the blue and the classification is a very important metaphor, because it not only frames the way you write about things and the way we analyze things, but it also frames the way people think strategically. And I do believe that the DCCC probably missed the opportunity to pick up close to a dozen seats because they were thinking in that framework as well, and they didn't realize opportunities until it was too late. They ended up losing 13 congressional seats by less than 3 points. And if they had dumped more money into some of those seats and believed the numbers, they might have picked up even more. Anyway, let's open it up. I'm going to repeat your question. Oh, no, you've got a microphone. I forgot we don't have to do that.
Bruce, I'll be your wingman.
All right, so let's start in the back there.
Okay, please speak into the mic.
Sure. My name is Ralph Carmona, and you mentioned Proposition 187 and its impact in terms of the Latino vote, the growth, the Latino vote, and the voter registration impact. And then you, another one of you, made reference to the Asian Pacific Islander vote and how there was some uncertainty as to whether it was influenced, to what extent it was influenced by 187. And you never made no mention of the role of the African American vote. And then you missed two other major propositions. I mean, there were really three racially related propositions. There was 227, 187, and 209. Do you have any research that shows the influence of those three propositions in the aggregate and how it impacts this whole question about red and blue and purple?
Well, I've done some work on all those propositions. And I will say this, that there was a dissertation that just came out of Stanford a couple years ago that analyzed the effect of these and discovered that really 187 was the critical one in terms of the mobilization of the Latinos. And what he did was he compared what happened to Latino registration after 187 in California with comparable years in other states. And you did not see the uptick in the Latino registration that you saw in California. We went up, I forget, it was about 2 or 3 points almost immediately after 94. That did not happen in Florida. That did not happen in Texas in the same period. In terms of the effect on the African American community, the African American community was already heavily Democratic. What we know, some work that we've done, suggested that actually on 187, they were less opposed to 187 than the Latino community. So if anything, 187 was a bit of a divisive measure, particularly in San Diego County, we discovered. With respect to the last of that troika, when you got to 227, by that point, you may recall that the Republican candidate, Lundgren, I think it was Lundgren, right, at that period, backed off of embracing that. So at that point, this gets to Mo's point that there's two things always going on in an election. One is what's on the voters' mind, and the other is the way people posture themselves. By the time you had 187, you had a clear distinction between the Democrats and Republicans. By the time you got to 227, the Republican Party had realized it was in the oops mode, you know, we've gone a little too far with this, and had gone back to the middle, taking the issue, I think, out of play. It wasn't a major point in that election. I think the reporters can correct me, but that was my view. Okay,
particularly on the African-American point, we found when we look at party identification for African Americans, it really has not moved, basically hasn't moved at all over the last 20 years or so. But remember, there's a real ceiling effect here. I mean, African Americans were already so overwhelmingly identified with the Democratic Party, but there's basically no movement.
Yeah, and I think the first thing you mentioned, API Americans, that's an area that's screaming for more research. The political incorporation, the gains in legislative representation of API Americans has been huge in the last few years. And the question is that demographic trends? Is that people becoming citizens? Is that people becoming registered? Or is that, you know, geographic concentration? What accounts for that? That's a big area for research.
And my general point, just to be a little contrarian, was Prop 187 is kind of a convenient excuse for Republicans. They can say, well, we're losing because we antagonize the minority, the demographics are against us. My point was they have a lot more things wrong with them. Even if they hadn't antagonized 3 or 4 more percent of Latinos in the vote, they'd still be losing elections.
Hello, my name's Michael. You talk about two different factors, one being party registration, the other being party identification. Is one factor determinative over the other? I mean, are DTS voters really swing voters, or do they vote according to which party they identify with?
I don't think we know. I mean, I think what's interesting is that we do seem to have two indicators of party, and they're not exactly consistent, so I think we probably need to take a look at that. Just come back to this point about how are they voting, swinging, and so forth. We continually say voters are moving. We continually say, and this is a thing I've harped on, Bruce has harped on, we say Kansas is moving red, California is moving blue. Well, often it's not the voters who are moving, it's the candidates who are moving, in the sense that the Republican running this time is different from last time. And so the national Republicans have become more attractive to people in some states. They've become less attractive to other people in other states like California. And so it may not necessarily be the voters moving at all, like Ted's data showing same number of liberals as before, same number of moderates. And what we're seeing is candidates repositioning, and we tend to interpret that in terms of voters repositioning, and that's not what's going on.
Okay, pick it up a little more.
A number of people who were involved in the Take Back Red California have commented that Democrats who move from the Bay Area into the hinterlands seem to turn Republican. Can you comment on that?
Well, I mean, we saw this with political trends in Nevada, sort of why did people move? A big part of, you know, why you might move to the exurbs or to the hinterlands is because either you're a moderate Democrat, or you're reaching a time in your life when having kids in the SUV is more important. And so I think there are a lot of, you know, the reasons people move drive that rather than the actual movement changes them.
Right. We did a study for the LA Times back in the 80s where we tracked Latinos that went from the Boyle Heights area into the San Fernando Valley. And we discovered that they did change their registration at a higher rate than those who stayed in the same place. But I think Thad's point is right. We were never able to answer the question, had they already moved in a more, in their attitudes, in a more Republican or conservative direction, or did getting there and getting with the neighbors make them feel like they had to blend in more? And that's a hard one to sort of tease out for us, because it assumes that the voters know what they're doing, and we can get inside their brain and figure it out. And we've spent a lot of time, Henry Brady in front, all of us have spent a lot of time trying to get inside voters' brains, and it's pretty hard.
When you look at the growing number of declined estate voters, the question that jumps out at me is, who are these guys? Are these people that, you know, rejecting the other parties, or are they just rejecting the whole idea of party identification? Are they the moderates? Are they conservatives? Who are they?
Mo, you want to give it a try?
You know, I really don't think we know. I mean, I my intuition tells me these are people who don't find either party attractive enough. You know, there are arguments that people vote as, register as independents, so they can vote in either party's primary in certain kinds of states. But there's no possible reason why in Massachusetts you'd want to vote in a Republican primary. So, I mean, it's, I don't know. I mean, I sort of tend to think we're reaching the end of an era when the parties are defined by a set of issues which younger people coming into the electorate are not that turned on by. And so that's sort of essentially the battle seems less and less important to them. But that's just a, sort of a more intuitive kind of sense of what's going on.
This may be something that the Marx will pick up in the, in the next...
Jay Miller.
One thing to note, and I agree that there's a lot of uncertainty, but traditionally in the identification questions, political scientists have used a 7-point scale that uses three categories of independence: people who are what they call, what's called pure independence, and people who are who say that they're independent but lean towards the Democrats, and then another group that leans towards the Republicans. And those who say that they're independent and don't lean towards either party, they're referred to as pure independents. There hasn't been a lot of movement in that in California in the last 20 years. I mean, despite the rough proportion of pure independents has remained pretty constant.
Yeah, these are folks who vote with the party just as much as they just reject the label more than the behavior. That's been the traditional finding.
Yeah, so it is possible that we're just seeing more of that.
Where is he? Okay, go ahead.
With the characterization of areas by red, blue, purple, I'm interested for everyone in the spectrum of how that affects their sense of political empowerment, whether they feel that they as individuals, once they're in a labeled area, actually have empowerment, and how that would affect the city, county, and state sense of being engaged in government or having a voice.
Well, I'll take a stab at that. I mean, I do think that most voters don't realize whether they're in a red, blue, or purple. They rarely know what districts they're in. But what they do probably indirectly sense is whether they're in a competitive area or not from the amount of activity and attention they get. So I think their clue about where they are really comes from the activities that the elites undertake in their area. And so if you're in a really dead area that has a lot of minorities in it, the odds are you're in a pretty deep red territory, you know, that kind of thing. But again, I don't know that these frameworks that we have seep down into voters than that they think of their neighborhoods, unless they're very, very politically involved. I think it's more a label that journalists and analysts were using as a way of recognizing that there's a geopolitics to American politics, and that because of the nature of American institutions, geopolitics matters. If we had a different set of institutions, if we were in Europe with a PR type of system, we wouldn't be worried about this at all, except insofar as it led to certain kinds of riots and tensions. But because we have an electoral college, because we elect senators by states, and because in California, as Thad was pointing out, we have these two different parallel mechanisms of governance, one which is based on geography and the other one which is based on statewide electorate, the equivalent of an at-large electorate, because of these institutional features, the geopolitics of the state actually matter. And a lot of people in political science and a lot of reform groups are asking the question, well, what the hell? Why do we have a system that depends upon these contingencies of geography. Why don't we join the rest of the world and get to systems which hinge on other kinds of identities? Of course, that brings in a whole other host of problems that we could go on and on about, but that is kind of the nature of the debate in the reform community right now. Peter Schrag.
To what extent are voters, and you know, we try to characterize them as independents or as liberals or as conservatives, to what extent are they simply schizophrenic, that they will vote in the same period for stem cell research, to prohibit gay marriage, to increase penalties on juvenile crime, to legalize medical marijuana? Is that liberal, conservative? What is that?
No, voters are not ideological. I mean, you know, people in elites tend to see the world wrapped up in liberal conservative terms. But you're right. I mean, Montana voters in 2004 passed medical marijuana by 60-40, and they passed anti-gay marriage by 60-40. People make decisions on a case-by-case basis. They say, this sounds like a good idea, that doesn't sound like a good idea. And if you're sort of a Berkeley type, and you're trying to figure out, well, how are they liberal, are they conservative, the answer is neither. Those terms don't matter to a lot of them.
Well, not there's some people that matter, yes, but a lot of people in the middle.
No, right.
And again, this gets back to George Lakoff's point that you can't assume that everybody in the middle is in the middle on every issue, that they're somehow moderate on every issue. The middle can be exactly what Arnold is, which is this bundle of incredibly contradictory views, because he says people are biconceptuals, that is, they're liberal about some things and not liberal about others. And what's happened in American politics is that the social dimension of politics became much more salient in the last 10 or 15 years. And so some people who are conservative on social issues are liberal on domestic issues. And I think, but you're saying even within the same spectrum you find contradictions, and that's true too because of what Mo said. Yeah. Okay, Carla.
You all mentioned that the African-American vote and how loyal it is, it's been and stable it's been for the Democratic Party. But Schwarzenegger did make inroads with the African-American vote, and I think it was 30%. Maybe some of his people here that could tell us. But he went out and hired people. He did make inroads. Does that, do you suggest just his own personal... that it was one guy who was able to do that, or does the Republican Party actually have just been writing off this vote and not really capitalizing on what's potential gains they could make there?
Well, I guess when I said that African, in terms of party identification, there's a lot of stability, but over at various times, African Americans have differed a lot in terms of particular candidates and particular races. It's just when in terms of returning, they tend to return to Democratic identification, and in races where the lower visibility races, which are defined more by party, they tend to vote African American. So when you look at, they tend to vote Democratic. So you look at legislative races and things like that. But no doubt, over the years, African Americans have bounced around in terms of views of particular. Particular candidate, just like other ethnic groups have.
One last question.
Yeah. I poured over a lot of the same data you folks have, and I'm going to make an observation and get your reaction to it if I can. That obviously there's a rise in independent voting. Obviously that some areas have become redder than they were before. Some areas have become bluer than they were before. But it strikes me in looking over the data that the big change has been in Los Angeles County. That the collapse of the aerospace industry in the early 90s sent hundreds of thousands of aerospace workers out of the state. Their places were taken by immigrants, largely. There was a rising of a Latino-based labor movement at the time. And that the big change in California politics over the last couple of decades has been the voting pattern in Los Angeles County, from being a fairly neutral county in statewide elections to one that's solidly Democratic. And that really pushes the state as a whole into the blue realm. That's my observation, and I just would ask for a reaction.
Dan, is that particularly in the San Fernando Valley that changes?
I go over Long Beach. But
Dan, it's not just L.A. I mean, Orange County has changed. I mean, Orange County used to be reliably Republican on all kinds, and it's not.
Pretty solid Republican.
But there are cracks
in the orange curtain. I mean, but we've.
Yeah, and we've seen that play itself out more in legislative politics. That's where most of your speakers have been in the recent era, and less in statewide politics. You know, a lot of the gubernatorial candidates and Senate candidates have been from the Bay Area still for the Democrats, and I think that, again, plays into Los Angeles is the area with a lot of legislative seats but relatively fewer voters.
John Elwood.
Okay, you've talked about religious issues. You've talked about ethnic issues. Isn't there some national, some national results that say recent elections, income and class have become more important when you run the regression, and that sort of undermines the David Brooks view of the world of two plutocracies fighting each other. And my question is the national literature, does that work in California?
Good question, Bob.
You're right. The data show that the income divide in voting has gotten bigger, not smaller, despite the Thomas Frank, what's the matter with Kansas. It's actually what's the matter with Connecticut. There's a paper on that. It's in the rich states. The income no longer predicts the vote. In the poor states, it actually predicts it very well. California, I don't know. I'm not a California specialist.
I mean, the interesting thing about California is in 1946, average income in this, personal income in the state was 35% above the national average. We're now 2 or 3 percentage points above the national average. It tells you that something might change. Except that income drives the aggregate. Something might be going on.
Right. Immigration. Okay. Unless somebody has an absolutely pressing need to ask a question, I think we'll stop. There are some refreshments in the back. We're going to break for approximately 10 minutes, I think, while we set up for the polling panel.
Right. It should look just like
all structural.
Yeah, that's exactly.